can't handle the truth.
No, Jack, you can't handle the truth. See, the truth is that All Things Film offers the best value in free movie podcasts on the internet. That's right, free, as in it costs you nothing. Daily Grindhouse, Films and Swearing, a movie podcast. It was only £1. La La Film, Maths, Movieside UK, Podcast on Fire, and of course Filmsploitation, the All Things Film podcast. All free and all available online on iTunes, on the podcast app, on Stitcher, on TuneIn Radio, direct, or from www.allthingsfilm.co.uk.
As far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster.
See, as far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a podcaster. All Things Film, the premium film movie podcast feed on the net.
Welcome to Podcast on Fire 185 on A Better Tomorrow Free and On the Run. One's a prequel to a groundbreaking heroic bloodshed movie. One represents a detour from doing acrobatics and fighting alongside his Peking opera brothers. And one is therefore Choi Hawks, A Better Tomorrow Free, and the other, Alfred Cheung's On the Run, starring Yuen Biu. My name is Kenny B, and with me is Tom KW. Say hi.
Hello, everyone. Oh, just I put ice and sugar in my coffee. That's not very nice. That's not very good.
Everything's ruined!
He's popped a shot, clearly. No, nothing's not ruined. You know, nothing. We're off to a good start here, Ken. We're both optimistic. We're both, you know, free-loving, freelancing. It's a groovy time here at the Pop Network. I'm feeling at the moment there's a lot of stuff going on. A lot of shows going off and on. I'm back off my sabbatical for me gammy leg I had, and it's good to be
what
back.
What shows are going off? I wasn't aware of this.
Ones that I'm creating behind your back, Ken.
Taiwan Noir is no more, Ken. Like, what?
No, sorry, Ken. That's off.
Week in Sleaze.
Sorry, Ken. That's out. We're doing just low-key mainland romantic dramas now, and if it doesn't fit into that, then
low-key from four.
Yeah, low-key. We're doing low-key, so it's normal. It's kind of like low-key just being a bit quiet, do you know what I mean? Not usually being himself. He's just kind of sitting in the corner going, oh, you know, romantic comedy, stuff like that. Do you know what I mean? It's those kind of vibes.
Younger brother of Thor.
Yeah, he's just crying a bit, and he's just crying very quietly in the corner while we record.
I got my Loki pokey stick.
Yes.
I can poke at people, and they're magically mine.
Hit me with your Loki stick, Ken. Again and again.
The more I record this, the more I feel... I felt under the weather before, and I just feel my energy drain. I can't even respond. I can't even respond in an energetic way, like, to be funny about it. So let's just get on with it and podcast about Hong Kong cinema classics, or not classics, as the case might be. We won't know until we get into this, but let's do some quick contact information and get into A Better Tomorrow Free. This is Podcast on Fire on the Podcast on Fire Network, podcastonfire.com, for the show, all the other shows that are still on, hopefully, and the bonus episodes. So email us, podcastonfire@googlemail.com, if you want to ask something and give us some feedback and what have you. You can also do so and discuss with us on Facebook, like our page, facebook.com/PUF Network. Every 10th like generates a little piece of charity out of my own pocket, just because I like charity, and that also generates some increased likes on our page and what have you. And you who click that like button, that's all you need to do. Doesn't cost you a thing. You'll generate. That's what you're doing, and I appreciate you doing so. And we've given a healthy amount to charity, so there you go. And on that page, there are updates and what have you, but we also have our discussion group. You type in Podcast on Fire Network into Facebook search bar, or follow the link in the About section on our page. Follow our Twitter, our own Twitter. We've created a new Twitter, like a rogue Twitter. twitter.com/podcastonfire is our account. I write about Hong Kong cinema and Taiwanese cinema, Richard Harrison's exploitation, and movies that are directed by Godfrey Ho, and some movies that are not directed by Godfrey Ho, despite being ninja movies. SoGoodReviews.com is your one-stop shop for that. I think that's the expression. Anyway, SoGoodReviews.com, SleazyKVideo.com, I do spoken audio video reviews kind of thing.
I thought you said spooky video reviews.
Spooky.
It's just you going, this film wasn't very good.
Richard Harrison. SleazyKVideo.com for my video reviews, not on camera, thankfully, though. Twitter.com/SoGoodReviews is my account, so follow my tweets over there. Podcast on Fire is on iTunes, the whole network is, and you can rate and subscribe to us over there and leave a written comment if you have the time. That would very much help us out, and stream us on Stitcher Radio. You can do that via their website, Stitcher.com, but best way to do so, the streaming thingamajig, is on their via their application on the various devices that download applications, your iPod touches, your iPhone, iPads, or Android. And once you're in Stitcher, type in Podcast on Fire, add us to your favorites, and stream away. Tom, VCinemaShow.com, has there been any new content from Tom W during the summer?
There hasn't been any new hot summery sweaty action on there at the moment, no. Unfortunately, I've been busy with the whole life thing, whatever that is. I'm off my sabbatical now, so you might see a few tippity-tappity things. Got quite a few things that need to be finished off. So maybe you'll see the money shot soon off me, you know. You'll see that.
Digging the hole. Keep digging the hole. You can't stop talking too, Tom.
Oh, okay. I didn't want to do any dead air. I just want to keep speaking. You pass the baton to you as I stop.
It's a good enough plug. Your reviews are on there, and we'll link to your review archive as usual. And that means we are taking a promo break. And after that, we'll be back to discuss About Tomorrow 3 from 1989, Choi Hak's prequel to About Tomorrow 1 and 2. So we'll be right back.
Hello, it's Chris and Pete from It Was Only a Pound.
Hello.
We do a podcast where we get a film that costs £1, and then we talk about it. So we watch it and then talk about it. Sometimes we watch terrible films. Sometimes we watch films that we think are terrible
sometimes
and actually turn out to be good.
Sometimes we watch boring films.
Sometimes we watch boring films. But generally, we have good chats. Where can you find us, Pete?
You can find us. We're on iTunes. We have a website at www.itwasonlyapound.co.uk. And we're on Facebook and the Twitterverse.
So please come and check us out and leave reviews and stuff. Thank you.
Thanks.
Welcome back, and we are going to talk About It Tomorrow 3 from 1989. We've done About It Tomorrow 1 a year or two ago. We last episode, you and I were on, we did About It Tomorrow 2 and created some new enemies in the process, I think, as we ripped that movie apart. But About It Tomorrow 3... We'll see what our verdict is in a little bit. But plot from my review of the film. First of all, Mark, played by Chiang Fat. This is the same Mark from A Better Tomorrow 1. It's not Ken from A Better Tomorrow 2, but Mark from A Better Tomorrow 1. He travels to Vietnam in 1974 to meet up with his old friend Mun, played by Tony Leung Ka Thai. Mun needs help to raise enough money to get him and his father, played by Enter the Dragons, Sek Keen, back to Hong Kong, away from the escalating Vietnam during war times. They know the money can't be obtained legally that fast, though, and with the help of Kit, played by Anita Moy, they set up a heist against the military that, after some complications, is successful, and they leave the country. Meanwhile, both Mun and Mark have fallen in love with Kit, and why wouldn't they? Because it's Anita Moy, and she looks gorgeous in this movie.
Oh my god, in this film, man, yeah, just can't get over it.
But anyway, they eagerly wait for her to join them in Hong Kong, and when she returns, so does her past, and Mark and Mun are suddenly in great danger. I'll do my brief opinion first, and I'll pose a question, and you can kind of mull that over. So, is its connection to A Better Tomorrow, the Better Tomorrow saga, is that valid? So have a little bit of thinking about that.
Okay.
For me, it is valid. Minus the scene with him getting the coat and the glasses and some music. There is also, at the same time, very little that Choi Hak does to nod his head to Better Tomorrow 1 or 2. So with it being a prequel, is that this is necessarily not a question for you, but you might think that it's a desperate commercial move, but it would have been if the movie would have sucked, which it doesn't. In fact, for my money's worth, it's stirring. It's really exceptionally well made. It's really cinematic. It's big images, big music, iconic movie stars, stylish action. And it may look on the surface like Choi Hak is channeling Wu, but it's somehow different in style. And there are more attempts to analyze all of that as we go along. Do you think it kind of belongs to Be a Better Tomorrow Saga? Does it have a valid place being here at all?
For sure, man. Yeah, for sure. I've always been the opinion of that. Obviously, I like this more than A Better Tomorrow too, but it's definitely a different film.
Yeah.
But I think this is just a lot better made and a lot well made. And I don't think it's maybe elite kind of classic, you know, Hong Kong cinema, but it's definitely underrated in my mind. And I think more people should see it if they have dropped off with a second, because it brings something different to the table. And no, it's not Hawk, you know, kind of trying to copy Wu, because I don't think it's more of an emphasis on a love story kind of between, you know, two brothers and a girl. You know, it's not very much kind of that overtly kind of male, you know, kind of male, looking at kind of male relationships and looking at kind of the way they pan out, which Wu is known for. I mean, this is much more kind of a straightforward love story, and it's just a very good drama. I think the action's sparse. When it does come, it's really good, though. But I think it's more than anything, the drama is just very involving. The few moments that you mentioned briefly aside that just kind of are a bit too, you know, a bit too kind of heavy-handed. But yeah, I mean, I feel like if this was just called Love and Death in Saigon and not really kind of, you know, without the Better Tomorrow moniker, then maybe more people would have seen it and it been a bit more kind of, you know, better rated. But as it stands, I think it's a very good sequel, yeah, very good sequel.
And you're very right. It seems like that is people's problems with it, that they don't feel comfortable like lumping it in with the Better Tomorrow Saga, which I kind of understand, because minus a few elements, yeah, it's a separate movie about, you know, it's gunplay in Vietnam and Hong Kong in the 70s. It's a period movie, and it doesn't really matter. Watching A Better Tomorrow 1 doesn't become enhanced by like 50% knowing A Better Tomorrow 3, you know, those are the glasses and the coat. Like, that's pretty much it.
Yeah, I don't think you even go into it. I mean, yeah, I don't think I've ever gone into the first one kind of thinking about the third one, like, oh, is that where that came from?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, it's just more kind of it works kind of on its own, really, to be honest.
And the funny thing is, it is 1974, yeah, but Chiang Fat doesn't look at all younger. He looks, you know, it's supposed to be about 10 years earlier than A Better Tomorrow, and it's kind of like, really? Is it 70s, really? Well, whatever.
It's 10 years younger. the guy just devolves kind of through time. Like,
he's stuck in time, literally frozen in time. But this is Chiang Fat, after all. I mean, he looks dashing and charismatic and what have you. So you roll with it. And I've heard along the way, like, various tidbits and trivia, and I haven't researched it prior to this, that Bullet in the Head kind of at one point was slated to be a Baltimore Free sequel, and Wu went on to make his own Vietnam movie, i.e. Bullet in the Head, because in Bullet in the Head there is a, albeit deleted scene from the most common version, a scene where the trio drinks urine. They're forced to drink urine. And that story turns up in A Better Tomorrow 1 as a kind of a backstory in terms of Mark's and Ho's adventures together. So I think at one point, again, I think, and please listeners do correct me, that there was an idea to bring A Better Tomorrow 3 back to Vietnam, and with that kind of story strand realized. But Choi Hak and Jong Woo went their separate ways. They did make The Killer together, but yeah, they made a separate Vietnam movies, and neither is like redundant or anything. They're very different movies. Bullet in the Head, way better, but this is still pretty good, actually.
Yeah, I think it was probably, I mean, they're probably around Better Tomorrow 2. They're probably kind of, you know, they have a very good collaborative, you know, relationship up to that point. And I think maybe around that time they were both planning, you know, either a prequel, you know, Vietnam, you know, they were kind of both going towards that line. But, you know, after kind of them splitting up after Better Tomorrow 2 and all the problems with the editing and the kind of their relationship kind of turning a bit sour there, that I think it might just be a mutual thing, mutual kind of respect to each other, that they're both going to do their own, you know, Vietnam movies, and maybe just Choi got there first to have the, you know, Bert's Mara 3 moniker. Cause,
yeah, it was not like he stole the script and made it first,
I mean,
anything.
It's not, you know, Wu directed, you know, first, but, you know, Choi's, you know, fingerprints are there, and he produced it. I think he's got kind of well right to go out of his way to, you know, to produce a prequel. But,
sure.
Yeah, as you said, Bullet Head, the better film, in my opinion, a lot better film. Maybe it speaks to me more. You know, maybe I prefer Wu as a director, maybe. But I still think this is, you know, it's almost equally as good, but for just very, very different reasons.
It has some similar beats as it opens, but the story dictates, like, okay, characters arriving in a turbulent Vietnam, so you got to see some turbulence. And I think, you know, there's a short period of... so to say, happiness between Moon and Mark before they go into the whole square where there's a lot of turbulence and protests and violence. And it's kind of effective it's not groundbreaking or mind-blowing, but it's kind of affecting how Choi Hak charms us a little bit by having, you know, Chiang Fat and Tony Leung like flirt with the girls on the other bike, and then those girls are actually carrying a bomb and they're actually killed, and they see these this violence like up front, and the images are pretty big here. I mean, it's not a tiny little shot in a warehouse type of production. It's not a quickie. Like, it's backed by a vision. Or what do you think in terms of the, like, scale and epic nature of it? Is that something you like?
No, yeah. I think he could shot himself in the foot by not coming with the kind of the budget to, you know, back the idea. But the budget's there, and kind of the location's there, and the cinematography's there, and... Yeah, I mean, yeah, you speaking of that, kind of that first scene there where they kind of first arrive and they're kind of going around the kind of the central area of the town. Some of that looked like it was real footage to me, like some of the kind of either that or very, very kind of good naturalistic acting. Like a couple of the confrontations there, it seemed like it'd been mixed in a bit with, I mean, seamless kind of mixing in. But like a few moments to me just seemed like it didn't look like acting. It seemed kind of like very realistic. The confrontations between a couple of the protesters and a couple of the army dudes, it looked very kind of...
I don't know where they shot this, if they went to Thailand or Vietnam or what have you, but you know, who knows, regardless, it merges.
Yeah, yeah, it instantly sucks you in, just kind of to the kind of the protest and the kind of the unrest of the location, and just that, where that innocence is just shattered straight away, that kind of flirtation there, and then they're dead, like they're just gone, like it's very, very hard hitting, but it almost is like you can just, the public themselves are kind of, it's not just certain people and certain protesters, it's kind of like the whole public is up in arms, and these seamlessly innocent girls kind of have something to say against the government, so it kind of instantly kind of pulls you into it. But I think that's what this film's good at, is balancing the kind of the family stuff and the relationship stuff, and then we get this kind of hard-hitting scenes of kind of why they're there and what's going on in this place, and it's a very good balance, tightrope to walk, but I think Choi walks it very well.
Yeah, you're right, and there is more time for relationships. Obviously, we get a one that is embodied by Sekin, who plays Tony Leung's father, and his ties to Vietnam are very strong, as he has his little medicine shop there. He has his Vietnamese assistant, the character of Pat, that you think is kind of dumb and mute, but as a matter of fact, he isn't. They just have a language barrier, kind of. Because he speaks later in the film as he returns. But, you know, having Sekin there is obviously guarantees veteran the presence and kind of just, it's a good role. It's a fairly meaty role, but still, Sekin was not just this, you know, lame-ass martial arts guy or anything. He's a proper actor, a proper, like, veteran actor for many, many decades. And it's good to have him here in a what could have been a way too melodramatic role. But he keeps it grounded, especially as he has to depart from Vietnam and leave his kind of adopted son, Pat, behind, which the relationship is obviously has evolved into that.
It could have got bogged down a lot with some, you know, if it got a bit too melodramatic with the acting, but it's kept reeled in and is very effective kind of as the film goes on.
Let's talk a little bit about the action then, because what I love about this one, like the push into action, is kind of rousing as Choi. Combines having Anita Moy there, who looks gorgeous. She has a 4D as an action heroine.
Who definitely needs an M16 and a handgun at the same time. Definitely.
And a long white coat, the long curly hair.
Can we just say how gorgeous she looks in this film, man? Like, I don't know what it is. It's the curls, man. I don't know what it is. It's the curls. Like, she just looks amazing, like, in this film. Like, just, again, like, it's just, yeah. She's always just looked so good in it. And she's just so kind of, she's classy. She's always just looked so classy in this film. We've talked about Annie or like just so many podcasts before, but again with this film it just kind of reminds you just the presence there, the presence, that low-key presence, but she's good comedian as well, but you know, just kind of in that dramatic, that low-key role, she's good, man. The dramatic scene as well, and well, you know, especially what happens towards the back end, it's just so good.
It's like the combination of the filmmaking and having a performer like her that is really cool and makes this like initial push into action, as you know, the first shot kind of that is fired during this confrontation with the military that I talked about in the plot synopsis, when Anita Moy first pulls the gun from the back of her jacket.
Yeah.
And they're like, it's a slow motion shot, and then lower lows and David Wu's music cue up, like, di 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 di.
Yeah.
You know, it's really like that is rousing, man. It's like Choi Hak was never like the gunplay director only. Obviously, he had style, but he still wisely does this thing of, oh yeah, we got guns, we got slow motion, but I'm not like shamelessly ripping off John or anything. It seems to me he's trying to do his thing. What makes sense for him. To like create graceful, cool, rousing shots rather than just changing the frame rate and then be done with it. You know, it's and what I was surprised about was that there's not a whole lot of blood in this movie. The focus is not the squibs in slow motion. I think it is rarely
fucking explosions, man. That's what the focus is on. Like, especially like back end, like, yeah, and that first set piece, like, yeah, just shit goes off. Like, it's madness. But
the thing is. The thing is, what I ultimately like, almost the summary of the action, is that there is a genre feeling here. Yeah, it is heroic bloodshed. And I am hoping that most heroic bloodshed fans wasn't scoffing at how he did action. But I really don't know, because I don't, I never had a good like appreciation for how the fan community viewed this, other than that they didn't like the movie as a whole. But I don't know what they thought of, if they thought the action was lame or anything. But no, I think it's really, really rousing. And it's Anita Moy carrying this. They obviously are. Mark is not an action hero. You know, he's thrust into this. He's a loyal friend, and he turns into more of a hero as the movie goes along in a kind of classic cliche way. But it's suitable development, because you got a charismatic performer like Chiang Fat combined with the romantic drama and all of that, so it works, even though it's not the best story ever told about a guy who grew into a gunplay hero. <You know?
laughs> There's a lot of them knocking around. I agree. I think they all get equal billing as well in terms of kind of the things to do and material to work with. It's never kind of just a one-man show. I think, you know, Chow and Anita and Tony, they all get, you know, good meaty roles, and they all get good. It's never kind of like you're kind of siding with one person. You're always very interested in kind of the three of them and their stories and how they're kind of interweaving with each other's stories. And it's good. And it's heartbreaking, especially when it gets, towards the back end. But before that, when it gets into kind of like them, they're both almost vying for, Kit's affection, the two friends. So it gets a bit heartbreaking. Yeah. And it's very real, kind of the kind of what's expressed between them both and what they're expressing for her. So, kudos.
That's the only thing that I thought initially, like them two and their connection to Kit, like liking her as a friend and loving her, was kind of a quick transition. But here's why this works: this connection coming too early, but what follows is this wonderful goofy montage with them trying hats and glasses, and it's set to Anita Moy's like very stirring power ballad, and she teaches Mark gun skills, and he almost shoots his friend by mistake. You know, it's a going good montage, but it does kind of just work and make you like this trio, even though it's a quick transition from like two scenes together, one big action experience together, and then they're bonded like you read about. So I always had a little bit of problem with that, but the montage and her song is kind of just great because they're all iconic and it works.
It's very much so. They go into the local mall, you know, Chow goes in and comes out into the changing room, comes out in like a nice dress, and you know, Tony's laughing at him, pulling faces, and you know, trying on different outfits. It's wacky.
The actual wacky dumb thing about the montage is at the end of it, Tony Logue plays guitar with the club band. Like, okay, he apparently knows how to play the guitar.
Well, it's part of the. Some of the deleted footage as well. He's sitting, he's with his guitar, as if you forgot about the band stuff. You know, he is in a band, Tony, because he's sitting in the car with his little guitar that we get to see that. So, yeah, he can play music really well.
Yeah, you're right. He does play acoustic guitar in one scene. We don't know that those all of a sudden, boom, he's in a band. He's like the Vietnamese Beatles is playing now. I don't know. Again, the slick nature of the movie makes it like thrust forward, and the professionalism is what like gets me easily through this. I mean, this is also kind of painted by nostalgia, this, or colored by nostalgia, because it's one of the like first five Hong Kong movies I ever watched, and it was my first original VHS purchase as well. I have the Made in Hong Kong VHS of this, and I bought Tiger on the Beat, or Tiger on Beat. It's on the beat on that VHS. It's called On Beat. And also City on Fire. So I had, and I remember watching A Better Tomorrow 3 first, just because there was fire on the cover, like fire on the cover, fire, fire, fire. Because I was young, I kind of liked fire. it's a fairly long movie, but it never like, felt long. I always felt it moved fast. Then I still do. The uber evil customs officers are a bit cartoony for the movie, but here's again Choi Hak saving himself, because you know when Choi Fat confronts them, they bully Sekin's character and cuts up his luggage and destroys his sign that was in the medicine shop. That like foreboding, like dumb. Now Mark's gonna fight back. That really, like, that gets to me every time. Yeah. Those moments, Choi Hak is very good at, and it's not like he just does a little bit of slow motion, but yeah, he kind of just focuses on, like, making us remember moments, and that I like, and it doesn't, like, make Mark this invincible gunplay hero, even at that point. That it takes up until the final section of the movie for him to, you know, start wielding anything dual.
It's true, Choi, he knows what he's doing, because we get that scene initially with Chow and the airport staff. So it's kind of like when it goes a certain way. So when it appears again, kind of like an hour in, it's almost like you think, oh, which way is it going to go now? How's it going to go? What's going to happen? And you think like, oh, are they going to be saved? Are they not? You know, is something bad going to happen? So he knows what he's doing. You know, he plants the seeds there and then kind of waits for him. And then when we get the kind of, you know, retake of that scene an hour into the film, it works really, really well, calling it back.
I love, by the way, how awkward, perfectly awkward, and I'm saying perfectly and literally meaning it, Tony Leung's character thinks he's got the deal sealed with Kit, pretty much. He has many awkward moments where it's clear that she's not as heavily into him as she is into Mark. Like, after this scene that we talked about with Mark confronting the customs officers, Anita Moy kind of comes in and saves the day, not coming in there shooting guns or anything, but accuses them of corruption and what have you, and has to stay in Vietnam. And their parting moments, it's kind of like this. Tony awkwardly like kisses her on the forehead. And I love how it's played, because it is supposed to be an awkward moment. Like, he thinks their connection is so strong that this kind of will work. And I love when awkward on screen works as well as it does here, you know? Tony is really, really good, because this is Tony, like kind of geeky Tony time. You know, as the 90s went on, Tony became more apt at and got more roles where he was more of a heavy and scary. But here in the 80s, he could do Gigi Tony very, very well, and it works so well for this role of Moon. So I dig the trio because of this, but ultimately it develops into this romance where, without spoiling it, Mark and Kit have this connection, but then he thinks they don't have a connection, and he becomes a bit jealous, so he orders in a bunch of hostesses at a club. So we got those beats too, but without good actors, those beats would have been kind of unbearable.
Yeah, it's true, and it's good that, you know, Tony, he does go for that kind of nerdy kind of Tony, because I think, you know, to try and Chow and him kind of out-cooling each other throughout the film would have been a bit kind of, you know, boring, would have been kind of too much, but he's good that he's got his own kind of character there, and the way he interacts with, you know, Kit differently to the way Mark does is, just a testament to the acting chops in this film.
You know, I haven't said that about Geeky Tony. He could channel that in the New Millennium as well. You remember the Herman Yao movie, Papa Loves You?
Oh, maybe tell me about it.
Where Tony plays the faro, Charlene Choi, and he's wonderfully geeky and out there, despite being a middle-aged performer. He's not afraid to make a fool out of himself, which is why I love Tony Leung Kar-Fai. So there you go. And also, we're talking a lot about like the drama and the romance. And yes, Choi Hak doesn't shower us with action every 20 minutes. He trusts the romance. He trusts the strength of the actors and those moments like carry us on. And it's all very sufficient storytelling, but combined with excellent technical merit, which makes this you know, non-original template very affecting, even at points. You know, we care, and that's where you're going right. That's when you know you're going right, when you get the audience to care about what happens in between the dual machine gun stuff, you know?
Yeah, it's not all about the action. I mean, yeah, it's quite sparse. When it hits, it comes strong and it lasts for quite a bit. I mean, especially like the finale's like half an hour or something like so. When it does hit, it hits good, but it really takes time to kind of focus on the drama, and I think that's what makes good action films in general, is that you need to care about the characters, and if you don't care about the characters, it makes the action, no matter how good it is, redundant. So to care about the characters, to care about what's going on, and the dramatic heights that have been kind of pulled before the action takes off, then, you know, you're there. That's perfect filmmaking for, action, dramatic filmmaking, definitely.
And it shows also when you look at the heroic bloodshed genre as a whole, knowing all its classics and its copycats, that this is far from the camp of the fun copycats, but still obviously copycats. It's up there in terms of it's one of the better ones, even if it's not the best one.
I agree.
And I always like that when you immerse yourself into a genre and watch every kind of like low rent, lo-fi Xerox copy of a Xerox copy, and then go back to or see for the first time something that is a classic in the eyes of the critics. You realize that they are in different camps in terms of professionalism and dedication, and there is dedication here. And, you know, even hard workers like the actors, Chang Fat included, you know, making so many movies at this time. He's on. He's there. He's not phoning it in. I can't think of many performances where he phoned it in, where like, I can see that he had like he focused on his award-winning role that he was shooting that afternoon instead. You know, no, he's on. He's there. And
always.
And yeah, without spoiling it, the dual machine gun ending, kind of iconic. It's cool. I don't think we ever see Chiang Vat with two guns, but it's two machine guns, and that's kind of cool. That's like there's some very stylish shots here, without it being a Better Tomorrow 1 and 2 refread in terms of style. I like Choi Hak's view of gunplay. I really do.
Yeah, it's more kind of intimate as well. I think it's less thousands of people getting shot and more kind of nice kind of action, dramatic beats between kind of, you know, three or four people, rather than it being a lot of people just taken out. There's a lot of explosions and stuff and cool stuff, but if it's a more kind of a bit more kind of intimate than the previous kind of films finales, definitely.
And I agree. And when all is said and done, there is decent emotions at stake, and everything suitably increases throughout the movie. Like the music gets bigger, the images gets bigger, and the crescendo kind of reaches its fever pitch during the end where they leave in the helicopter. And I won't spoil anything, obviously.
The cinematography kind of in those final moments is just beautiful. Just kind of they pick the perfect time to shoot it in the perfect location. And it just works really well. And the song and... Yeah, yeah.
It is a location shoot, definitely. I don't think this was... a lot of it was shot either in Thailand or Vietnam, I believe.
Yeah, it was definitely... I don't know whereabouts, but it was definitely... you're definitely outside, because you couldn't get the shots that, you know, he achieved towards the end without, you know, being on the back lot.
Exactly. So it's... I don't have any other notes other than I still like it. I've watched it a bunch of times over the years, and I still like it. It has its place in the saga because that's what the story is like. You know, it's the story of Mark 10 years earlier or 8 years earlier or what have you. And there it is. And you can think... you can kind of, in your head, delete the connections to A Better Tomorrow 3, 1, and you see that it works on its own too, you know. So you even get a character called Ho here, but that isn't the T-Lone character from the first one or anything, but there you go.
It definitely takes more of, I think, one of the best kind of Hong Kong sequels kind of all time, really, just because the fact that it does its own thing and doesn't kind of try and replicate exactly what made the first one special, and it just comes with something different. Because I can't think of a lot of sequels that really kind of, I mean, there's definitely a few and definitely kind of a lot by prolific directors, but I mean, yeah, there's not many that comes with its kind of own distinctive kind of taste and you know, works for that.
Sure, definitely, I agree. So really, that's the end of my notes. So do you have any other notes, Tommy?
That's it, man, really. Yeah, I mean
we're gonna mention the Taiwan edit in the availability section a little bit, so let's just do it then. As for availability, it is represented on DVD and Blu-ray. It lies with Fortune Star and their distributor Cameron Ronson in the case of both formats, and as discussed before on various shows, including the last one you and I did, in all likelihood most of the Blu-rays that Cameron Ronson put out based on Fortune Star elements are, including this one, offers no true high-definition transfer, but rather an upscale of the DVD of the remastered print. And the Blu-ray only, in the case of A Better Tomorrow 3, and the rest of the Better Tomorrows, only comes with a full-on surround sound remix of this mono-only film. And having the DVD where you got both the mono and the remix, I sampled the remix, and as per usual, it's just Fortune Star layering new crisp sounds onto an old mono film without much care for making it fit well.
What are you gonna do?
Wide mono is a very, very good option for 5.1. I saw Hardboiled recently via the Maya 5.1 remix, and they just widened the soundstage in a subtle way. No directional effects like guns going from left to right or anything, but just widen it a little bit. And I gotta tell you, Tom, doesn't that sound simpler to do rather than new Foley in the fucking computer?
The worst fucking thing is that sometimes they're not even kind of taking out the old effects and they're just muting them and then they're putting new ones over them, because there's countless ones I've seen where you can still slightly make out the old sound effects, but they've just got these new, you know, different guns, like they just sound completely different. It's just not, yeah, it's just not right. It just doesn't feel kind of organic to the original film whatsoever. But
If you notice it, then there's something wrong there, obviously. But on the DVD set of the trilogy that is available, there is a mono option, as I said. So my recommendation, buy the DVD set with all three modes.
The newest Hong Kong box set has got everything on in terms of audio, I'm pretty sure. So that's the one to go for.
I think what Fortune Star has done is put out the set in a few different cover variants. I have one that is slightly older, but the one on, for instance, Yes Asia has a different cover, but presumably it's the same content. But for the Blu-rays, they just mono sounds like it's for old people, so just let that go.
What? I've got mono?
You kids, get off my lawn and give me my mono! On the DVD of A Better Tomorrow 3, there are a few scenes from the Taiwanese edit of the film as extras. It does exist in full, like start in the Star, like TV library. They struck a full print of the Taiwanese version, because it's been on mainland DVD and it's also on the French Hong Kong Video, that's the label, set of the trilogy as an extra feature. I mean, an entire extra feature. So there's four movies in that set, the French set. And it's kind of funny. I own the VHS and the UK VHS from Made in Hong Kong, put out in the 90s. And I thought the Taiwan edit was considerably longer, because the UK VHS is like 100, 105 minutes, and the Taiwan edit is it's a few minutes over 120 minutes. It's actually not the case. Listen to this. The Made in Hong Kong version was, yes, from the theatrical Hong Kong edit, but it still was missing several scenes that actually are supposed to be in there, because they are on the Hong Kong DVD of the theatrical version. So, as a matter of fact, the Hong Kong DVD is about 120 minutes, and therefore the Taiwanese edit is only a few minutes longer in actuality. So I don't know what went wrong in terms of what Made in Hong Kong got, but if you watch it, the continuity is kind of off at points really clearly, but I'm so dumb that I don't see these things until they're really presented before me.
Paul Star seems to go out of the way just to do anything in terms of kind of just make kind of masters and edit them whichever way they want.
But the thing is here, Tom, I think the thing is, I know what you're getting at, but this time I heard that A Better Tomorrow 3 is represented as it should be represented. This is the theatrical cut, yeah. And the old VHS was missing a lot of stuff. So there you go. If it actually has a few extra scenes that are not supposed to be in there, it's still not disruptive. By the way, the film is A Better Tomorrow 3. That is also referred to as A Better Tomorrow 3, Love and Death in Saigon. Made in Hong Kong, along with that fire color, fire, fire, fire. They called it A Better Tomorrow 3, The Making of a Killer.
What?
Rock and roll, hardcore.
Boom!
Yeah, boom, fire.
Explosions.
Tanks. So there you go. That's A Better Tomorrow 3, people. Let's do a break. Talk of On the Run after a break. Let's run through the break and talk of On the Run.
you are hilarious.
I'm so sick and I can't think of any funny stuff. But I can't think of any funny stuff even when I'm healthy. So there you go.
This man is delirious.
But listen to some promo break that I'll pick for you, for a podcast that you should listen to. Our friends in the podcasting community are doing fine work, so go out and support them. But for now, listen to their little promo that they put together. So,
hi, I'm Phil Hobden, host of Filmsploitation, the film podcast. We think we're pretty good, but don't just take our word for it. Here's one of our friends.
Greetings from Tromaville. This is Lloyd Kaufman, president of Troma Entertainment and creator of The Toxic Avenger. You know, folks, when we're not making those great movies like Tromeo and Juliet and Poultrygeist Night of the Chicken Dead, the Troma team and I like to kick back and enjoy Filmsploitation, because Filmsploitation is the best entertainment and education that we know.
Check out more at www.thefilmpodcast.co.uk. We're on iTunes, we're on Stitcher, and we're probably in your closet as well. No, we are, really. Could you let us out, please?
Welcome back in the final review of this episode. It's the musical episode! It's the musical episode.
You're right, mate.
For now, we've turned into one of those musicals where even dialogue is done in song, you know, like the whole like the Lemmy's musical that was put out there last year. All they did was sing in that one, not even talk for one bit. Like Russell Crowe sang every one of his lines. So we're gonna sing the podcast review for you.
I think Shrek the musicals like that as well. Just thought I'd let you know that.
I like musicals. I don't like that kind of musicals. I like it to be a play and a musical at the same time. You know what I mean? Like dialogue and then music. Like break out into music like in suitable intervals rather than all the time.
That's true. That's true.
Just a preference. But hey, anyway, On the Run from 1988. Let's talk of this Hong Kong cinema critically acclaimed movie, and we'll let you know in a little bit if we think so as well. A plot from my review of the film: Cop Huang Ming, played by Yun Biu, meets his wife, whom he's separated from. She's a narcotics inspector. They meet late one night in a restaurant to discuss whether they might have a future together. Again, separated, not divorced. After he leaves the restaurant, the character of Yu, played by Pat Ha, hired assassin enters and brutally executes her victim, which is Huang Ming's wife. A crushed husband, Huang Ming, decides to go after the woman, but when he catches her, he realizes that both his and her life are in great danger. It's in great danger. The people who hired you are out to silence them both and will do anything to achieve that goal, and that group of people are headed by the man Huang Ming's wife was seeing. Police Superintendent Lui, played by Charlie Chin. So there's, it goes up all the way to the top, so to say, this conspiracy. My brief opinion, first of all, in the 80s and 90s in Hong Kong cinema, you have amazing versatility on display, obviously all over the place, but some versatility stood out. Some versatility was like taken to a new level, and all of a sudden some profiles made and starred in an actual film. You know, some Hong Kong cinema, they're barely films. They're like strung together bits for 90 minutes. And we're taking on a mood swing kind of journey. But when it comes to the personnel that are present here, you know, we're used to them taking swings at each other, but certainly not making dark fare. But on the run is dark fare. Yun Biu got a chance to shed his acrobatic action persona. Did it very well. Alfred Cheung, the director, he had some odd and quirky dark elements in his movies before, both as a performer and director, but he produced something unexpectedly dark, and here's the brief opinion in actuality, unexpectedly good. Wow, this is a straight thriller with a dark streak up there with the best of them, and it's a classic in my book. But what do you think, Tom?
Yeah, it's another Stone Cold classic of Hong Kong cinema. Yeah, really good. A fine example of kind of something that Hong Kong cinema didn't do a lot kind of pre Johnny To, and that's kind of like this kind of neo noir kind of take on things. You know, you get this and stuff like The Big Heat and Long Arm of the Law to an extent as well, which is this kind of dark kind of neo noir kind of tales, which weren't done a lot, but when they do, when Hong Kong seems to kind of have a jab at them, they did it really, really good. And this is just, this is just jet black, straight down the middle kind of thriller with certain action elements, but just kind of it's only like 80 minutes, just top to bottom, just enthralling, kind of gripping kind of stuff.
And what was Johnny To during it this time? Probably The Eighth Happiness.
I was just going to say, I mean, it took a bit, and obviously kind of it's,
The luck and the tycoon.
Yeah, it's almost kind of become a thing, you know, with Johnny To. That's kind of part of his, you know, his kind of directorial kind of flair is these kind of, these neo-noir kind of stories. But yeah, before this, I mean, like the 80s, you had a kind of few, and the ones I mentioned, and they're all great. It just seems like kind of whatever this arises in Hong Kong cinema, it's done very, very well.
And the response by all in this movie is very, very inspiring as well. I mean, Pat Ha, you know, I've been a dramatic actress, and she'd been in varied movies, so it was not so much of a leap to see her do well in a dramatic role and as a very like stone cold assassin. But it's inspiring still to see the response by all. Like, I didn't know Alfred Cheung at this point in the filmography had this in him. You could argue that Yun Biu probably had it in him, but he was not given a chance to do this like relentless, cynically violent, like grim movie. You know, you kind of expected this out of early Hong Kong 80s Hong Kong.
Well, yeah. By the time New Wave finished, it kind of died around then, and obviously we kind of had Happy kind of stuff.
This is angry. This is
that stuff. Yeah, you know, the kind of Lunar Year and stuff, and you know, the kung fu and the kind of modern day action, and kind of just always just kind of like an air of kind of energy, and not energy is probably not the right word, but kind of like just kind of a happy-go-lucky kind of vibe with a lot of the films coming out in the early 80s. But yeah, I mean, here this is black, man. Yeah, really kind of dark and just relentless, kind of in its attack on the viewer.
And it's just like a stylishly lit movie that isn't like...
Oh, man, cinematography is so, so good.
And I'm glad it's good because it could have gone... Because Hong Kong cinema, they knew how to do these scenes every now and again in movies like moody scenes. But to do quite an extended feature of moody like cinematography like and the neon lights and the signs making the scenes glow, and you see... like a lot of red and blue and a lot of green and like people walking in shadows. You know, it's very moody. And Hong Kong cinema, since they didn't do this continually, you'd think like they'd have a little bit of trouble adjusting from happy-go-lucky times and some heroic bloodshed dramas to this. But and even having action and kung fu performers tackle this material too. But you still, and also at the head of it, like the dark, like the chief, like literally the chief, you know, intended Lloyd, Charlie Chin's character, plays a very dark, like, and the ultimate villain in this movie. And he was normally like a half-rob and goofball womanizer in Lucky Stars movies. So there's a lot of jump to an onslaught of not comedic anymore, but something way different. Like, it's not a funny moment in the time movie, thankfully, you know.
Yeah, I mean, again, with like just you know, Sammo, obviously, you know, action direction on this and producing it. And again, like in this period, he really just branched out with certain things and, you know, made a Western with Millionaire's Express and made a dark kind of, you know, army kind of movie with Eastern Condors and, you know, war film. And it's he really just branching out. And again, this is another kind of home run, just with kind of he set out to do an idea and there was some creative force there behind wanting a vision behind this to kind of have it a dark thriller. And it just works. And there's no goofy kind of humor in this, or nothing kind of creeps in to kind of spoil the mood. It's kind of back to front, keeps, again, a thing that I really appreciate about the film is just the quiet moments. And it's really allowed to breathe. The film is with certain scenes and facial expressions and dialogues almost kept to kind of the essential basics and what needs to be said. And it's such a creative period for Hong Kong cinema in general, this kind of late age, especially with Sammo producing or Sammo's involvement.
You bring up a very good point. He'd been doing fairly dark stuff, Sammo, actually.
Dragon's Forever to an extent as well. Like, I mean, there's definitely dark moments with that.
I'm thinking more Heart of Dragon, actually, to be honest.
Yeah, definitely.
Because,
definitely.
That was like a very like nihilistic Sammo and Jackie movie, for real, you know, not just the odd like dark moment, a really like nihilistic movie coming from them. So it's probably good that you had Sam around to make sure this came off as honed and skilled as it did, you know. And it's funny though, I mean, you know from the beginning that okay, we got a character trying to hold his family together, Yuen Biao's character, and it quickly shatters from no hope, no future, to even worse.
Yeah.
And technically they just go for it. I mean, there's no off-screen, there's no regular like body squib rigged up here, but they've rigged up a special effect to the forehead of the female actress, and you get, you know, grim executions
straight
like this
in,
you know,
straight in, yeah, straight in with the violence and the kind of just that mood just hits as soon as the film starts.
And, you know, I really dig that there's no Alfred Cheung, he doesn't let up after this. And this it's simple plotting too, like the killer of his wife and they're going to pair up, you know, holy shit. That is
unique. It's definitely a unique kind of thing. Yeah, like kind of that relationship's formed from that. And it's not overtly kind of, you know, they don't have to kind of put down in words, or what does this mean for each person. They just go with it. It's just kind of taken as it is and gone through with it. And it's just, yes, yeah, it's brilliant the way that's done. It's not kind of banged on the head. It's just kind of, this is how it is. And this happens. And it's very, very, very unique.
And it also, in terms of like this being a grim and kind of nihilistic movie, a character like Yuen Biao has to learn of this corrupt world and start reacting to it and counter it, because you know, it's gonna like mow you, like run you over and chew you up. And he definitely needs to react with violence as well. And I'd say it is a very, very good movie. The only thing that it's not intentional, but unfortunately for me, it is funny, is the group that Charlie Chin has around him, you know.
The best lineup of villains ever seen in cinema.
Here's the problem I have here. You got Law Lead here, you got Yung Hua here, and the thing is, what I find amusing and kind of it kills off the menacing aspect of them as a group is they always move in group, like they are glued together. They always move up the stairs glued together like they're zombies or something, like, or robots or something.
Yeah. You definitely feel that divisional aspect to it, because obviously there's a bunch of, there's different kind of divisions of, you know, the police, they're kind of, you know, the CIDs, and they've all got different departments, and that's an interesting aspect, and they're kind of moving, you know, throughout the film as kind of groups. So I've never seen it like that. Yeah, I mean, I've never seen it like that. I've always just kind of assumed they're a tight knit group, and obviously they've got a problem, and they're all kind of sticking together to get rid of that problem. But I can see where you're coming from with that.
They're really tight knit, because they're really glued together. Like, we can't move, Sam. Why did you use super glue? For a laugh. Oh, hey. But I like the younger guy in the group. I don't have the actor's name now. Twitching.
The twitchy guy.
As soon as violence is like there, like, oh, we can perform some violence now. Who is choking her or him? Like, and his face twitches, like he gets off on it, and that's like really, really dark.
Dark, man. Yeah, it's dark. He's good, man. But yeah, there's such a good lineup of villains. Like, I do like it, and you know, yeah, obviously Charlie Chin playing against Ty, but you know, the rest of them just fit in perfectly kind of into that role. Really good.
They do fit in. There are some over the top moments towards the end, but what an assortment of actors and action performers. Like,
yeah.
And you're right, throughout this, like, it's the movie is moves very well, but it also relies on, as we alluded to earlier, like quiet, very subtle moments of bonding, especially with Pathas, you bonding with the kid, little actress Chan Chuk Yan, who, and yeah, her mother has been killed. Hung Ming knows this, but they need to stick together, and there are some fine bonding scenes between them.
And it's not overdone at all as well, either. I've always felt like with it, it's never kind of overdone to that point, like, especially with Pahar's mom, she's always kind of restricted, and she's never like, oh, I love that kid. Oh, we had such a great time together before when, you know, when you were bleeding over there. Like, yeah, we had a really great time. Like, it's never too much. It's always just kind of restraint and always held back, and she just alludes to wanting a daughter for herself. Like, just one, it's just kind of one sentence, kind of one throwaway line, which is always great as well. I feel like, again, that could be too, especially, like, if you involve kids, I think you and me have had this conversation, like, those ones before. If you involve kids in films, it can go horribly wrong, depending on kind of, you know, just what you give them, the material they give them. But again, this is a prime example of doing it right, and her involvement with, you know, both leads is really good.
And this is, by the way, listeners, the little kid from Wild Search.
Yes.
And
yes.
And Fatal Termination. They hung her outside of a car.
She's that, Fatal
famous Termination.
Famous girl, yeah. Famous
so,
girl.
So she had, I mean, they did it safely, of course, but they put her through some dog shit.
Yeah, I was going to say,
and,
yeah.
I mean, she's about 4 or 5, 6.
The late 80s, early 90s were rough for her. She had a rough period.
and hopefully she's all right now that she's an adult and all of that. But you're also right about Pata. She is like, not, she acts cold and cool and to a point, but she's not a totally callous character, but it's not all warm heart and sunshine either. You know, she's a professional who got screwed over doing what she thinks is right in the moment, but she's also saving herself, obviously, not in a selfish way, but she has to react in that way, and that doesn't mean like going off on her own either. So it's a movie where you kind of after a while realize that everything goes to hell, everything will go to hell, anyone is fair game. And, you know, if you have an elder character in your family, that elder character is probably going to get shot in the eye. Alfred, I mean, he's obviously associated with the her Fatal Ways series as being a very successful series, but it also went on for many movies, four, I think. And that is quite a lot, quite a lot of movies, as a matter of fact. And these were also, these were sync sound movies, her Fatal Ways, all of them. And Alfred was one that pushed for sync sound in his movies. Unfortunately, not in this one, but I think for that time in the late 80s, early 90s, it was not common for Hong Kong movies to have live sound recorded on set. But Alfred was one that wanted to push for this professionalism, and it's very appreciated when you can hear, obviously, voices. And it makes sense, really, in Her Fatal Ways 4, and I'm glad they did sync sound, because Carol Cheng's character falls in love with a Westerner who speaks Cantonese and English. And yeah, they could have dubbed it, but normally in Hong Kong movies, if they had a Westerner there, we'll just dub them into Cantonese. I mean, even movies that are set in like in the UK and what have you, with you know, British police officers and what have you, they'll speak Cantonese. Don't worry about it. So I'm glad when we get the other, you know, other side of the coin, and Alfred was good for providing Hong Kong cinema with a little bit of professionalism. I'm thinking now on Alfred, I'm going to check if he actually directed the movie with an amazing title. Yep, he did direct that movie. It sounds like a goofy comedy. It is, but also very dark. And it's called, and I think that was Sing Sound too. And it's called Talk to Me, Dickie. Or Talk to Me, Dickie. But
Talk to Me, Dickie, or is it Talk to Me, Dickie? Which one? There's a comma, so I'm guessing there's a pause.
It's a like a, yeah, his penis talks to him. Oh my God, this is pretty dark, isn't it?
That's actually the plot.
Among other things, I mean.
Okay. Well, I didn't know that was. I didn't know you were going down that route, Ken.
I mean, the title is Talk to Me, Dickie.
Well, you know, it could have been Richard.
It's about the Cultural Revolution.
Let's have a conversation, Richard III. It's political.
You got to admit that you were thinking, like, exactly the way.
No, I wasn't thinking about Cox then, Ken. I wasn't. I genuinely wasn't. You surprised me when you said that. That's amazing. I need to see that now. That needs to happen for me.
You don't expect it to be dark. But it kind of was, you know, and
weird.
I loved Alfred for that. Even in movies that he was just an actor in, there's a movie called In Between Loves, which is part comedy, part also this slasher movie. And it's really effective. So Alfred got put in some darker stuff too. So it's pretty fascinating as a profile, both in front of or behind the camera.
He's a classic Hong Kong director in a sense, in that it's just kind of like fingers in every kind of genre pie, you know, throughout his career, and kind of a dab hand and try everything, kind of try every genre. So, and again, same with acting, like just try your hand at just everything, like, you know, producer, you know, right,
including talking penis movies.
Yes, please include, you know, that on your filmography, because that needs to happen, and it has happened, and that's going to happen for me. It's going to happen in my life. It's going to change my life again.
You talked of action elements, and there certainly are action elements here. There is a stunt in the movie that is rather amazing. Jump from a bamboo scaffolding kind of thing to a pole, a light pole. It might be Yumyu, because it's not done in one shot, okay? It might be Yumyu from the bamboo scaffolding to the light pole and then sliding down. But regardless who did that stunt, it didn't look safe at all. It didn't look like they rigged this person up on wires that were invisible. It looked like climb up onto the bamboo scaffolding, jump to the light pole, and try not to fall off.
Yeah, I know Chin Kolok was involved with the production, so it might have been. But it's definitely you kind of hitting the car at the end.
Yeah, there is not an entire fall from the top of the pole to the car, but yes, there is. They cut to, let's say, a medium fall, just to simplify it, from a medium height rather to the car, and then the car's windows shatters. So it's an effective two-shot stunt, but you know, you get reminded of Tiger on the Beat 2, where that stunt went wrong.
that is just crazy.
So it seems like why even do that when it's so risky? But I suppose they why not?
Why not? Let's go for it. But yeah, it's really, 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 really good. Yeah, like the rest of it, just really, yeah, restraint kind of in the action. It kind of happens, it bursts, you know, kind of bursts in kind of like the moment, and then the story continues, the kind of the movement. I find there's not a lot of kind of downtime with the film. It's just constant kind of roller coaster. There's a couple of quiet, you know, obviously, as you're saying, with the quiet moments in between, but there's always something moving, like. Even if the leads are kind of having a quiet moment, there's always something going on in the background, like someone's kind of chasing something down. And it's part of the film that just, well, the kind of the main part of the reason that it works so well is it's always moving.
And Yuen Biu at the helm here being a totally believable, you know, thriller lead, you know, as he gets more worn as the movie goes on, more injured as the movie it goes on, but it's this dark carousel that each reel holds something like life-shattering, really. And I love how Yumyu a response to that. I mean, he's a trained actor, for heaven's sake, you know, albeit a Peking opera actor, but still a trained actor. So it's not a stretch for him to get thrown into this and not do his amazing kicks and acrobatics and what have you. I expected this to be good when I saw it, but I was still, and still am, impressed the way he carries himself. It feels very natural for him to act, essentially.
It definitely is, yeah, and I think it's a shame that he wasn't given more chances to do this. Just kind of like, you know, this straight acting, this straight kind of thriller role. I mean, when he got his kind of his solo kind of outings in the 90s as well, they were more kind of, you know, fantasy, you know, wushu elements, and it's a shame that it kind of, before the kind of decade rounded off, he didn't get another chance to kind of put in a kind of another straight kind of thriller performance. But I think this is definitely, for my money, his best performance. Film is arguable. There's, you know, so many classics, but I think it's probably definitely his best performance. I'd say probably definitely. I think this is, I'd say I don't want to kind of stick to it, but I think this is, you know, it's up there. It's got to be in the running for his best performance.
Not that it's better or anything, but I remember seeing a Harmony House movie, Laughing Gore, a Turning Point, where Yung-Byu plays has a supporting role as a police officer. And by now, you know, he's aged, but obviously he's not going to do as much action anymore, but he's aged to a point where he can play these character roles very well, and he has some great, like, subtle one-on-one. In particular, a hospital scene between him and Anthony Wong's character in Laughing Gore that are like veteran actors going at it in a very quiet moments. And we know Anthony is obviously not an action performer; he's an actor. And but it's nice to see Yung-Byu as all this experience behind him and can just naturally switch into being a believable actor even now. And even here in 1988, that was also evident.
Very true. Very true.
If I'm going to nitpick a little bit, because I like the core of Yung-Byu, Pat Ha, Charlie Chin and his gang, I didn't find when they introduced the other cops, the other friends left in the force, played by Bowie Lam and actor Lam Lap San with a mustache. And Bowie Lam, beginning of Hard Boiled, he's Chai Fat's partner at the beginning of Hard Boiled, is functional for the plot, but not as interesting. But obviously, it doesn't bog the movie down for like a half an hour or anything.
No, still works for me. I don't think it's quite as intriguing. But I mean, saying that, there are moments that I think are as good as the rest of the film. But I think the whole, the plot line itself isn't obviously kind of how can you compare with the, you know, the main plot line going on. It works though, it works for the film though, definitely.
Just a few more notes, like I won't spoil the ending, but we'll talk about some few aspects, or maybe action aspects of the ending that takes place in an apartment. Some great, gritty, loud gunplay in the apartment, and we obviously get like the main fighting showcase, but it's not really a fighting showcase. It's a desperate brawl type of struggle between Yung-Byu and Charlie Chin. And at one point, I don't remember if it was before or during, but at one point, Yung-Byu's character's knee is all fucked up, and that really, and Charlie Chin shoots his own hand just to like prove a point, and then they go at it like animals, and everything in the environment, like chairs, like paper holders or something, like I don't know, but it's like Sammo Hung and his team just using power in a different manner compared to other movies. Like, they literally looks like the actors are killing each other here.
It looks like it's just not choreographed. It looks like just kill each other, lads. Just try to kill each other.
You know, hey Charlie, guess what Yung-Byu said about your girlfriend? What? Hey Yung-Byu, guess what Charlie said about your girlfriend? Okay, shoot. I don't know how you choreograph this, because it looks like they'll just bring in a record player and just bash that over Charlie Chin's head. That'll be good.
There's such a limited amount of space as well that it's so hard for them to kind of swing at each other. It's just very kind of one-on-one, kind of, again, just intimate kind of confrontation. It's pretty amazing. It's refreshing, and I don't think kind of a one-on-one kind of kung fu battle would have suited the film at all. Even if it would have been good and well choreographed, it would have just brought the film down, kind of the energy down, that it perfectly kind of caps off the film.
And my final note, really, before we talk some availability and a missing scene from the movie, is that, again, some of the grim stuff that happens to the group that Charlie Chin has around him is great, but I'm not too keen on the overacting by the group during this end, where they all kind of just, I wouldn't say all cry, but they're all in pain.
Yeah.
It's really too much. It takes me out of the movie for a few moments here and there, you know.
Yeah.
I mean? But what they do to them, again, not spoiling it, pretty grim stuff that you don't see in every even like mildly darker Hong Kong action movie. It's or Hong Kong thriller. It's it goes for it, and seemingly a lot is intact in terms of censorship and what have you. It sounds pretty gory. That's my point, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I dig it because I think it kind of feels like almost their true characters coming to the surface, and they're almost kind of acting like just this kind of delirious kind of manner. And what comes of that as well, I think, is quite smart. I do like it. I think because it goes somewhere. I've never had a massive problem. I can see why people would, because it's definitely the broadest acting that we get in the whole film.
Yes.
So I can see it definitely kind of, yeah, bringing it down for some people. For me, it works because it goes somewhere after that. I like the kind of transition.
And for once, let's just speak of it as vaguely as I can. You don't see in a lot of movies people that, after being injured, starting to fade and essentially die. There are examples of this in this movie that like that, like that it doesn't. Well, some grave stuff happens to characters that they'll bleed out. That's my point. That you don't see characters in Hong Kong cinema bleed out and start fading away and getting pale and what have you. But Alfred makes sure that there is that aura of realism here. That you know, if you're bleeding out, then you're bleeding out. That's medically like. Accurate, if you will, like you're not going to be this Chang Cheh style villain where you just tie a little bit of cloth around your wound and you're ready to go.
If hot lead goes through, yeah, you're going to get a bit tired. You're going to get a bit weary.
So yeah, that's but yeah, it's really the end of my notes. So before we talk of that extra scene that we can't describe without spoiling in the movie as well, so don't worry about it. But do you have any other notes before we talk that and debate?
No. But I think we've gone top to bottom with that. I'm just looking at my notes now. No, but I think we've hit everything on the head.
And but yeah, without spoiling it, most versions that are out there, because or were out there, or at least two of them, the Megastar DVD that I own and the Delta Mac one that was issued afterwards, they are missing one final scene that involves Peter Pau. He has a two-scene cameo, cinematographer Peter Pau, playing a doctor, and you can see him in an additional scene at the end of the movie. That scene is not in the Megastar and Delta Mac version. I think it belongs, because the UK tape had it, made in Hong Kong, actually put out this movie. The Hong Kong Laserdisc had it, and the remastered Fortune Star version has it as well. But this version has not been put out in Hong Kong. They only did a VCD joy sales, or it only has received a French DVD using this Fortune Star material, where this scene is obviously in. So that's a problem with On the Run. It's not easy to get it English subtitled anyway, because even the Joy Sales VCD that they put out, again, no DVD, that's out of print and it's hard to get. So if you want to get it on DVD, it's the French DVD, but there's no English subtitles on it. But that is out there. It's on Amazon.fr if you want to get it from France. But I'm sure there are some customs version out there, if you look for it, that has the English subtitles added. And you know, the dialogue that is in the final scene, you can add that quite easily if you're used to making custom DVDs. It's no problem subbing that scene by yourself if you have the Laserdisc and other sources.
Yeah, because there's the I'm sure that the VCD ends on the kind of the is it, well. Well, yeah, I don't want to say. Yeah, okay, I'm just what Ken said.
The VCD ends in the apartment. Let's say that. Because this additional scene takes place somewhere else.
Somewhere else. Yeah. The VCD takes place somewhere else.
I haven't seen it, so I can't confirm. But that's the kind of problem for On the Run apparently. But hopefully you can get it, listeners. So let's announce what we're going to do next time. The thing is, we've started this series featuring myself kind of interviewing and following along Paul Fox reporting from Hong Kong's recent, recent Hong Kong cinema, recent Hong Kong screens, and we've dubbed that kind of sub-series within Podcast on Fire, the Dynasty Report. So next episode might be that, but the next episode where we pair up two movies like and discuss it like we have will feature the following, and we will veer off the format ever so slightly. But the first movie doesn't represent that change. We'll be talking Hong Kong 1941, starring Chia Fat, one of his earlier dramatic roles in the very acclaimed war drama. But also because someone suggested this in the group, and I think because, you know, why not? Why not venture outside of Hong Kong but keep the Hong Kong connection alive? And what that means is we're going to look at one of the Hong Kong director's Western efforts.
Intrigued, yeah, man.
Double team. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, my God.
I love Choi Hak. I don't love Double Team. But we'll be talking of John Woo's Face Off from 1996 or 97. John Travolta and Nick Cage going at it. In my opinion, I can drop this opinion already. In my opinion, that's John Woo's best Hollywood movie. But I know people hate that movie too, so there you go. And and I hope to get a guest on that show as well who suggested that, but we'll keep it up in the air for now. We'll do the double bill anyway, you know, because I really want to talk Face Off on a podcast. It doesn't present itself, that option, very much. You have to create it yourself.
Very true, yeah. I hope people out there are digging our kind of doubles that we're doing, our double billing of the well-known classics. Hope people out there are digging them. You know, I think we've been cutting through quite a few good films that I think people, not we were sorely lacking on, but I think we were lacking kind of, you know, shows on. So I hope people are enjoying them.
One of the greatest teaser trailers I've ever seen in my life was shot for Face Off. Do you remember? It's John Travolta in a dark room talking about him chasing the Nicolas Cage character and how he's been doing that. And slowly but surely the camera rotates. And when he says, like, I only have one option left, and that is to become him. And by that point, we have cut to Nicolas Cage's face. You know, the transformation has happened, and that was specifically shot for that teaser trailer. I love that.
Man, I love trailers that like that, like they go out of the way, shoot something different, kind of just, you know, go, instead of just kind of having your usual kind of, you know, 30-second clips, just to that kind of going out your way to entice the viewer with something. But can you imagine that back in, like, you know, 97 or whatever, seeing that, like, I need to see this fucking film. Like, I need to go out tomorrow and see this fucking film.
and also, the trailer did contain action as well. And you saw that the parts of that amazing boat chase that John Woo did. And I love Face Off. For the record, I love Face Off, and I think it's affecting as a drama too. I makes me cry every time. It really does.
What a man!
what a pussy!
Come out and say that. What a man! Just come out and say that. To be honest, what a lad.
So there we go. But we'll do that next time, and let's finish off this show. This has been Podcast on Fire on the Podcast on Fire Network, podcastonfire.com. Hit that site up to check out other shows. Taiwan Noir, This Week in Sleaze, Japan on Fire, and we have bonus episodes on there as well. Email podcastonfire@googlemail.com, like our page on Facebook, add to the charity donation drive kind of thing by adding a like. That's all it needs to, all you need to do. So thank you for that support. facebook.com/POF Network. Follow the link to the discussion group on that page, or type in Podcast on Fire Network in the Facebook search bar to reach the discussion group and join the fun and the updates in there. Tweet us, twitter.com/podcastonfire, or just follow our tweets. You don't need to tweet us. You can be anonymous and just look at us. Look at us.
Look at me.
And there we go. And sogoodreviews.com, my writing of various movies, Hong Kong, Taiwanese, and obviously some ninja flavors present there as well every now and again, a lot. But anyway, sogoodreviews.com, sleazykvideo.com is where you'll find my video reviews, and my tweets are at twitter.com/sogoodreviews. Rate and subscribe to Podcast on Fire Network on iTunes and this show individually, of course, and leave a comment if you like the show, and even if you don't, please review us, and don't be a dick about it, and stream us on Stitcher Radio, stitcher.com. You can find that show over there, but the application for your various smart devices like the iPhone, like the Android, it's available too, and download it for free, and type in Podcast on Fire or any other network show to find us and add us to your favorites. And Tom, you're right, at vcinemashow.com, I won't stress you out by letting you like get do something comedic and like, I write, tappity-tappity-tap.
Every week, putting me on the spot.
I don't. It's just like, you become really nervous. VCinemaShow.com, Tom is one of the writers. He's got a review archive, and he might write something else in the future.
Soon, yeah. I appreciate whoever goes out of the way and reads them. I do appreciate it. Thank you. And kind words that are left from time to time about my reviews. Thank you.
Again, here he goes again. He can't shut up. Like, thank you and tappity tap.
Fuck's sake! You leave a space here for me. I can't. It's not take it. It's, what about the cinema, Tom?
You're just waiting for me to yell cut like a director or something.
That's what it is. I can't. I need the cues. I need the cues. Okay, that was good, Tom. Game offset now.
we'll dub it in later. We'll dub it in a proper promo later.
Where's my M&Ms with all the browns picked out?
Is that how you do it? Is that how you like the M&Ms?
That's how I do it. I just like colourful. I just like, yeah, just like a rainbow of M&Ms.
What's wrong with
like,
the browns? Obviously.
But they're just fucking up the rainbow flow. That's what it is. I just want a rainbow. Is that too much to ask for?
Not too much to ask for. I like that positive.
Spit those fuckers out, man.
Are there any licorice M&Ms available out there? Because if
no,
so,
but that would be amazing.
It would be. That would be my like. Get rid of the licorice M&Ms, please. So
there's M&Ms peanut butter now, man. Oh my god, get your lips around them. That's a recommendation. Both off today straight both off films and M&M peanut butter.
I'm gonna edit it so it sounds like you were talking about penis. It's your lips around them.
Penis. Oh, I'm just giving you that penis
yep.
now.
Thank you very much. Oh, and thank you and good night for this
fuck. Episode.
I've been Kenny B. With me was Tom KW. Say bye now. Cut.
Yes.
I would let it go on a loop as well. Like, yeah, put your lips around them. Penis, 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 penis.
Get your lips around them. Penis, 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 penis.